Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Catherine Ellis, attorney registration number 39356. I appear today on behalf of Mr. William Tolbert, the appellant and the biological father of the minor child that is the subject of this case. Here is our Supreme Court told us in 1976 that the power of the state to sever the ties between parent and child should be exercised with extreme care, and only when the evidence clearly establishes the necessity of so doing. That principle was confirmed in Troxell versus Granville by the United States Supreme Court in 2000, which also clarified that the interest at issue here, the interest in the care, custody, and control of children, is an interest that is perhaps the oldest of the fundamental liberty interests recognized. On appeal today, Father asserts that there were three fundamental errors committed by the trial court. First, that the trial court ignored significant and uncontroverted evidence of changed circumstances, demonstrating the likelihood that father would pay child support. Second, that the trial court exceeded its authority by concluding that the court-ordered support payment did not constitute reasonable support. And third, that the court failed to give sufficient weight to the father's established relationship with the minor child in terminating that relationship. Although I'm aware that the court's read the briefs and is familiar with the record in this case, there are a few facts and procedural history that are significant here and worth noting. First and foremost is that this case began with a petition to terminate and a request for step-parent adoption on July 17, 2009. The trial court initially granted that petition. Mr. Tolbert appealed that all the way up to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals reversed. On remand, however, although the trial court agreed with the Court of Appeals that there were problems with the original affidavit in support of the petition, and in fact, even though the trial court found that the affidavit of abandonment that mother and stepfather filed was essentially a legal misrepresentation to the court, that it arguably is misconduct by the petitioners in this matter, despite those findings, the trial court allowed mother and stepfather to proceed on the same petition, the same affidavit of abandonment, to try again on different grounds, this time for financial abandonment.
Had the initial affidavit also referenced the financial piece, in other words, failure to provide support?
Yes, Your Honor. The 2009 affidavit alleged both that father had abandoned the child and that he failed to provide reasonable financial support.
Thank you.
So on remand, although the trial court agreed that the abandonment piece had not been met and unequivocally decided that piece was no longer at issue, did decide that they could proceed on a financial abandonment or financial support issue only.
Well, I don't mean to parse words, but you called it financial abandonment, and that language isn't in the statute, is it? It's, I mean,
correct.
So the whole abandonment issue is gone, correct?
Exactly right.
Okay.
Yeah, so to be very clear, the abandonment piece is gone. It's the lack of reasonable financial support for a period of 1 year or more that was allowed to proceed the second time.
Understood.
Because the trial court allowed mother and stepfather to proceed on that same petition, the relevant statutory time period to determine whether there was a 1 year period of lack of financial support is therefore still measured backward from that July 2009 date, not from the date of the hearing on remand in August of 2012, when the trial court concluded that they could proceed on a financial support basis, and not from the date when they actually had the hearing on termination, which occurred in January of the following year. Mother and stepfather filed a petition in July of 2009, which was right around the time that father was being released from a 1 year period of incarceration. Father was found not guilty of the charges for which he was being held, but because he was on parole at the time the charges were laid against him, he was incarcerated pending adjudication, and so there had been a 1 year period of incarceration leading up to the filing of that petition. The first error that father asserts on appeal is that the trial court failed to give sufficient weight to the significant evidence of changed circumstances between the filing of the petition in July of 2009 and the date of the termination hearing in January of 2012. In step-parent adoption cases, the trial court has to consider three factors. They have to look at whether the best interest of the child is served by termination and adoption, They have to consider whether the parent failed without cause to pay reasonable child support for 1 year or more. And they have to consider whether there is any likelihood that the parent will provide child support in the future. And that language all comes from the RHN case from the Colorado Supreme Court. After finding that there's been 12 months where a parent failed to provide reasonable financial support, then the child court must look beyond that 12-month period to see whether there's any likelihood that the natural parent will provide support. That's from the ERS decision. And the court should consider evidence of changed circumstances in making that determination.
Can the court nevertheless still consider the previous pattern of payment? In other words, obviously that's relevant to the second of the two of the three inquiries, but cannot the court, in making that third determination, look both at the past pattern as well as changed circumstances and recent payments and the like?
Absolutely, Your Honor. In fact, the child court is supposed to. And the ERS case tells us the court must consider both of those things. The past pattern of payments, the consistency of the payment, the history of payment, but also whether there have been any changed circumstances. And significantly, one of the things that's particular to this case is that there were changed circumstances. This was not a case where a father sometimes paid, sometimes didn't, wasn't paying at the time of the hearing. This was a case where the father failed to make reasonable payments based on the child court's findings during 1 year prior to that 2009 petition. During that period, father was incarcerated. By the time of the hearing in January 2012, however, father was not incarcerated. He'd been gainfully employed, and he had paid his statutorily required child support payments for 2010 and 2011.
So is your argument here that the court didn't consider changed circumstances, or that it didn't appropriately weigh those changed circumstances in reaching its ultimate conclusion?
The latter, Your Honor, and that's our position, because the trial court notes the circumstances, notes that there has been payment. It's our position, however, that having noted that and taking that evidence into consideration, the court did not provide it sufficient weight in reaching its determination.
Okay, so given that, in our role as an appellate court, what is there in the record that would compel us to conclude that the fact finder here improperly weighed that evidence in the record, which I take it we, in our role as an appellate court, we would have to say that. I mean, and we don't often say that given what a trial court's or fact finder's responsibility is. So help me understand how you connect those dots so that there is reversible error here, which is, I think, what you're alleging.
Yes, Your Honor, there is. That's exactly right. The reason we would say that the record compels a different conclusion than the trial court reached is that the evidence of consistent and full payments in 2010 and 2011 is uncontested. This was not a case where we had conflicting testimony or conflicting evidence regarding whether father was now employed, was now making payments. The factual issues regarding the payment and the payment history were largely undisputed. There were some minor discrepancies regarding...
Wasn't there a dispute as to whether additional payments had been made?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's sort of the minor discrepancies I was discussing. There was some dispute as to whether father had made some payments before the registry was established, whether there were $50 payments here and there that were outside the registry, but the exhibit, I believe it was Child Exhibit Double H, as in hotel, was the Family Support Registry. That exhibit was not contested. Nobody disputed that the payments made to the registry were accurately reflected, other than those couple of additional payments that the father alleged he'd made. And on the basis of that, all payments, in fact, slightly more than required, was made in 2010. In 2011, without the additional payment that the father testified he'd made that wasn't reflected, he was something like $20 short of the required payment in 2012.
Is there an outstanding balance here? And if so, how does that factor into
the court's analysis?
No, yes, well, and to be clear, at the time of the hearing, there was an outstanding balance. So based on the record before the court, yes, at the time the trial court made its determination, there was an arrearage that had accrued. That arrearage, looking at the trial record, was almost exclusively the result of the temporary orders in that case. And at the time, temporary orders, the child support payment that the father was supposed to make was somewhere in excess of $800 a month, contrasted with the $50 payment for permanent orders. So almost the entire arrearage balance was the result of temporary orders, and so had accrued significantly prior to the 2009 petition.
That was a figure close to $20,000.
Yes, Your Honor. This case is distinguishable factually from the results that the court reached in ERS, because in that case we have a father who had made no payments for a period of roughly 17 months prior to the filing of the petition, continued to miss significant payments during the pendency of the action, had in fact missed three consecutive payments while the adoption proceedings were pending. And the court there found that the father was employed full time while he could have been or should have been making payments, that he was employed, living at home with his parents, had no significant expenses. And so in that case, the court noted that his failure to pay didn't really have any justifiable basis. Here, the time period that was relevant for determining a lack of reasonable payments was while Mr. Tolbert was incarcerated, and specifically while he was incarcerated for a crime for which he was later found not guilty.
Well, wasn't he incarcerated for part of that 12-month period, but not the whole period? The 12 months prior to the filing of the petition in July of 2009?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And that appears to be the relevant period under the case law, would you agree?
Yes. Okay. Yes. For determining that initial question of whether there was a one-year lack of payment. The second error that Father raises on appeal is that the trial court improperly interjected its own assessment on the reasonability of child support when concluding Father had failed to provide support. In this case, the trial court noted specifically that it costs more than $50 a month to raise a child, and that it was not reasonable support for Father to be paying $50 a month as child support. That conclusion by the trial court was in excess of its authority at that point. We had an existing child support order that was based on the statutory guidelines that supported by the legislature's wisdom in determining what is a reasonable child support payment, taking into consideration not only the cost to raise a child, but also the ability of the father to pay that support amount. In making that determination and in basing its decision, at least in part on that logic, the trial court committed a legal error by second-guessing both the legislature and an existing order. Father should have been able to rely reasonably on the child support guidelines and should have been able to expect that paying the court-ordered child support amount would not result in him having his parental rights terminated. And the last error that Father alleges on appeal, Your Honors, is that the trial court erred by not giving, again, sufficient weight to the relationship that he'd already established with the minor child. Case law in Colorado has noted emphatically that we must treat cases where a father has otherwise abandoned the child differently than cases where the child has an established relationship with the child but is simply not paying or has not paid sufficient support. And the reason for that is to ignore that is to ignore the child's interest in maintaining a relationship with father by focusing exclusively on parental fault.
In regard to that argument, isn't the finding of the trial court about the best interest of the child relevant?
Yes, Your Honor, it would be relevant. And the conclusion here, or the argument here that we set forth in the briefs is that there must be clear and convincing evidence. It's a heightened standard when you're dealing with terminating a biological parent's parenting time, that decision should not be entered into lightly. And again, although it is a difficult thing to convince an appellate court to do, the argument would be that there was insufficient evidence in the record, that it did not rise to the level of clear and convincing evidence sufficient to terminate parental responsibilities. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. And you've got about a half a minute for rebuttal, if you'd like it.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, Andrew Thorne, registration number 40138, on behalf of the appellee, Stephen Huff. Your Honors, this is not a case of punishing a natural parent for financial reasons or punishing a natural parent due to his incarceration. When this case was remanded to the trial court in 2011, the trial court vacated the initial termination of Mr. Tolbert's parental rights and vacated the initial granting of the adoption of the minor child. From that point forward, the trial court basically started the process over, held contested hearings regarding whether Mr. Tolbert's parental rights should be terminated or not, and whether the adoption of the minor child by Mr. Huff should proceed. The trial court, and the record is very clear on this, undertook a three-step analysis, as they're required to do under the statutes relevant to this case and under relevant case law. The trial court determined that it was in the best interests of the minor child to terminate the parental rights of the natural father and allow the adoption of the minor child by Mr. Huff. And we know from the RHN case that this best interest analysis is very fact intensive. The trial court had extensive testimony in November of 2011, January of 2012, regarding the best interests of the minor child. The record is clear. There was testimony from Mr. Tolbert, from Mr. Huff, from Ms. Huff, from the minor child's therapist, Dr. Camden. The court considered all of this extensive evidence, determined that it was in the best interests for the minor child to terminate Mr. Tolbert's parental rights and proceed with the adoption. They considered things such as the minor child's integration into the home of the stepfather and the mother at that time, his integration with siblings at that time, the fact that Mr. Huff had been a presence in the minor child's life since birth. This goes back to 2004. Mr. Huff was present at the child's birth. He has provided for the child financially throughout from that point forward. He's been a resource for the child financially. He's been provided emotional support for the child. He's provided a home for the minor child. By clear and convincing evidence, the trial court made this best interest finding. Second step in this process is determining, is the child statutorily available for adoption. We know from 195-203 CRS and from the RHN case that there are different criteria for a minor child being statutorily available for adoption. For purposes of this case, failure to provide reasonable support without cause for that 12-month period prior to the filing of the adoption petition is the inquiry that the trial court needs to make. The record on appeal is clear that the trial court did this. They analyzed the period of July 2009 back to July 2008. Mr. Tolbert in that period made documented support payments of $43.40. At that time, his monthly obligation was $50. There was testimony below regarding certain payments that may or may not have been made outside of the registry. The trial court addressed this, and they concluded that the documented payments are the payments that Mr. Tolbert made. Again, this is a question of fact for the trial court. RHN and FJH, these cases instruct us on that. The trial court is in the best position to look at the documentary evidence, the testimony of witnesses, the arguments of counsel. Clearly, based on the evidence here, the minor child was available for adoption based on that lack of providing reasonable support without cause. And I'd like to add that during that 12-month period, while Mr. Tolbert was incarcerated for a portion of it, there was a period where he was not incarcerated and, in fact, was employed. Incarceration itself is not a justification for terminating parental rights, but it is definitely a factor for the trial court to consider, and the trial court did consider that in reaching its conclusion on this issue. Third step in the process is determining the likelihood of future payment of support. RHN and ERS, two cases that both the appellee and the appellant have relied on, establish this third factor, even though it's not required by statute. The Supreme Court created this third step as a way of providing further protection to a natural parent who is at risk of losing their parental rights. And again, the trial court on this third factor has tremendous discretion. There's no rigid formula set out in either RHN or ERS that tells the trial court what specific factual findings it has to make. The case law, particularly ERS, says that it's a case-by-case analysis by the trial court. There are numerous facts that the trial court can consider on this issue, one of which is the consistency, duration, and regularity of previous child support payments. On this issue, the trial court examined the fact that for the first year and a half of the minor child's life, Mr. Tolbert made no support payments with respect to the minor child. When the minor child was 2.5 years old, a judgment for past arrears was entered against Mr. Tolbert for over $19,000 at 12% interest per year. At this time, not even compounding the interest, this is over $30,000 owed on arrears. Testimony in the trial court establishes that Mr. Tolbert has not paid down this arrears judgment. Trial court looked at the fact that during different periods throughout 2006, 2007, 2008, Mr. Tolbert was incarcerated, then he wasn't incarcerated, he was employed, then he was not employed. But the record was clear that from 2006 through July 2009, roughly 3 years prior to the filing of the step-parent adoption petition, documented payment of child support in the amount of $43.40. The court considered the payments that Mr. Tolbert made after the filing of the adoption petition in 2009. The court recognized that he did start to make payments in 2010 and in 2011, but, and the record again is clear on this, based on the totality of the circumstances, it was unlikely that Mr. Tolbert would make future payments on a consistent, regular basis.
So let me ask you a question about this third prong, and specifically about the court's comments on the $50 a month and how that couldn't possibly support a kid in these days. How dependent, if at all, is the court's ultimate finding on this third prong on those statements? Because if that's a major factor, it's a little bit troublesome to me, because the court is essentially saying, unless you volunteer to pay more than you've legally been obligated to do so, you're going to lose. And I had some trouble with that. On the other hand, if that wasn't an important factor in the court's analysis, maybe it's not so bad, but I'd like your response to that. Help me through that.
Our position, Your Honor, is that statement was really dicta by the trial court judge.
How do you get dicta? He said, this is what I think.
Taken in context, and he made that statement in January 2012 during the hearing at which he terminated Mr. Tolbert's parental rights. I think the point of that statement that he was trying to make was that, hey, $50 a month is hardly anything. In this day and age, to expect that to have an impact on raising a child, it's hardly anything. And he was commenting on testimony by Ms. Huff to that effect. And the court recognized that $50 a month payment requirement had been put in place in 2006 to reflect the incarcerated status of the natural father.
Well, that may all be right, but isn't it somebody's obligation then to go in and file a motion to modify?
Well, I think a natural parent certainly has that obligation to make that minimum required payment, but there are cases, FJH for example, where the parent paid above and beyond that required amount to in a sense demonstrate their commitment to preserving that parental relationship. Whether the $50 a month or not is reasonable, that was what was required of Mr. Tolbert, and he didn't meet that monthly obligation during the three-year period from 2006 to 2009.
Well, that's a different issue. I agree with that. The question is, in evaluating it going forward, if he's met it the last 2 years, I mean, is the court saying, I'm faulting you because you didn't pay more?
I think the court is considering the efforts made at making those payments going forward, but they're weighing it against this past record of non-payment. And ERS tells us that that is the proper analysis, that the trial court is to consider payments prior to that 12-month period, prior to the filing of the petition, and then the period after that, and to make a factual determination about whether the payments going forward are going to be consistent, because, and ERS touches on this, the custodial natural parent needs to know what they can expect in monthly payments. If payments are going to be in varying amounts at sporadic intervals of time, the natural parent who has custody can't really plan ahead based on that. They need the reliability of at least the minimum required payment. And I think to read into the trial court's comment about the $50 a month payment, I think the point the court was trying to make there was that even though this may not have made a huge difference in raising the minor child, it would have helped nonetheless. And it shows payment of that amount would show a certain commitment by the natural parent to the relationship. And paying even above and beyond that amount would show even more commitment. So based on the third prong, as far as likelihood of future payment, again, there's no rigid formula for this. The trial court considered extensive evidence on this, arguments of counsel, testimony, and determined that the termination of Mr. Tolbert's parental rights should proceed and that the adoption of the minor child should go forward. There's no reversible error here. The trial court's findings are supported by the record on appeal in every respect. A parent does not have an absolute right to their child in all circumstances. The case law is clear on that. JDK, for example, addresses that issue. We know that parents do have a constitutional protection of their relationship with their natural children. Because of that, a natural parent such as Mr. Tolbert must have fundamentally fair procedures before any termination can occur. In this case, based on the record on appeal, Mr. Tolbert was provided with all protections to which he was entitled. I would ask that this court please affirm the termination of his parental rights and the adoption of minor child. Thank you, Ms. Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Thorne. Ms. Ellis, if you would like, you've got about 30 seconds.
Yeah, with those 30 seconds, I'll address the court's question about the language regarding the $50 a month being unreasonable. The record's just not clear that that comment was dicta, that the trial court did not rely on that. In addition, the commitment to a relationship that Mr. Tolbert demonstrated here was not just making his $50 a month payment, it was also his repeated efforts to have a relationship with his child, exercising all of his parenting time, filing the initial petition, and appealing this all the way to the Court of Appeals now twice to preserve that relationship. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. We will issue an opinion in due course.